Hello, you're listening to the Northern Agenda podcast. My name is Rob Parsons, a journalist based in Leeds who keeps an eye on the ups and downs of Northern politics, and I condense it all into a daily email newsletter and weekly podcast. This week, I'm speaking to an author who's asked the question, how did the North become a place of lost potential and broken dreams? And what can be done to make it one of the most dynamic and forward-looking places in the world once again? Alex Niven is the man behind the book, The North Will Rise Again, which covers the colourful adventures of the North's inhabitants, the expansiveness and optimism that defines Northern culture. A native Northerner himself, Alex returned to his home city of Newcastle in the last few years, and he explores issues like radical regionalism, Northern identity, austerity, the impact of Brexit, and the collapse of Labour's Red Wall. If that sounds like your bag, keep listening for that interview in the second half of this podcast. But before that, with a general election coming, likely this year, and Labour miles ahead in the polls, I thought it was high time we scrutinised what a change of government might mean for the north of England. It's been very easy so far for Keir Starmer's Labour Party to slam the failings of Levelling Up and the promises of the Boris Johnson government that failed to materialise, but voters up here deserve to know exactly what the opposition would do differently if they got into power. So how much do we know about Labour's policies which might affect the North? Someone who's been looking at just that subject is Joseph Timmon, political writer for the Manchester Evening News. So let's speak to him now. Welcome, Joe.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me on.
No worries. So the spark for the piece that you've written for the MEN was a recent event that we both went to in Manchester at the Art Gallery, the 20th anniversary of the IPPR North think tank, where Labour Deputy Mayor Angela Rayner was the main speaker, amongst others. So just tell us about that and just give us a sense of what Angela Rayner said during that event.
Yeah, so I mean, the event itself drew in people from across the North who'd worked with this leading think tank, very well versed in sort of the issues holding the North back, and definitely opinionated on what needs to be done to sort of fix those issues. What Angela Rayner said was sort of, I suppose, reminiscent of a lot of other things that Labour have said so far, setting out this sort of vision without necessarily giving us much of the detail. So the general gist of what she told everyone in the room was that other parts of the country that currently don't have a mayor or have a mayor and don't, that doesn't currently have the powers that those in Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham in Greater Manchester has and Andy Street in the West Midlands, they will have the opportunity to have a mayor as well and have those powers in transport, housing. And then there was something about strategic planning as well. Again, on all of these things, there wasn't much detail, but the general gist was everything sort of going in that direction. In truth, that's sort of what the Conservative government have said as well. And there's a few sort of specifics, but very few sort of details on them where there's a little bit of a divergence.
Yeah. I mean, one person said to me that Michael Gove could easily have given the speech that Angela Rayner gave on that particular occasion. And I mean, would it be fair to say that it's taken a while for it to become apparent just what Labour would do differently to the Conservatives in key areas like transport and housing? Because, up until now, Labour have really just been happy to bash the Tories without offering much by way of an alternative. I mean, that's how it seemed in Angela Rayner's speech. Like, she went on about how Levelling Up has failed, and spoke about her Northern credentials and how many Northern politicians there are in Labour's cabinet. But so far there hasn't been loads of detail, as you say, has there?
No, exactly. I think it would be fair to go further and say they still haven't set out that detail. I think the only thing that I picked out from what she said that goes further than what the Conservatives have said so far is the issue of sort of who owns the buses. So currently there's a ban on setting up new publicly owned bus companies, and they said they'd end that. I mean, that's quite a specific thing, and we've got detail on that, but on the bigger picture things like strategic planning and how they'd use that to get big infrastructure projects through, it was difficult when I spoke to her directly and I spoke to other shadow cabinet ministers it is difficult to get sort of the detail on exactly how that will work. But no, I think you're right. They've not criticized the Conservatives for the ambition set out in the Levelling Up agenda, just sort of on the delivery of it. And I think that came across in what we've heard from them so far as to what they'll do. Pretty much what the Conservatives have promised to do, they're just promising to actually do it.
Yeah. I mean, as we're talking on a Thursday afternoon, and actually today, Shadow Transport Secretary Louise Hague is unveiling a few more specific details about buses. And she's talking about how she's going to remove some of the legal barriers which stop local authorities from taking buses under public control, to hopefully make it a lot quicker and easier to do what Andy Burnham has done in Greater Manchester. Because at the moment, the whole process takes years and years. She wants to make that process a lot more streamlined, and also allow mayoral authorities, areas of the country that don't have a mayor, so places like Lancashire maybe, or Cumbria or Cheshire, to go down the franchising route. Because at the moment, you do generally have to have a metro mayoral authority to do stuff like that. So there's a bit more detail. And I see yesterday there was a trio of Labour big hitters up in Teesside, Yvette Cooper, Angela Rayner and Rachel Reeves, who have unveiled a bit more detail about a 5-point plan to rejuvenate the high street, breathe new life into the high street, which includes reforming business rates, tougher laws on shoplifting. But your piece in the MEN sort of spells out some of the other differences that we do know in the Labour offer. I mean, are there any specifics that you think might interest people that are actually different that we know about so far?
Well, yeah. So my piece focused on what it means for Greater Manchester. And of course, in Greater Manchester, a lot of these things that Labour have talked about doing elsewhere in the country, we've already got. So the one difference, as I mentioned earlier, about the buses is and I spoke to Andy Byrne about this, it's something he'd consider doing, is setting up sort of a municipal bus company. So that would mean, rather than giving contracts to private companies to run services, you could have a publicly owned company bidding for those contracts as well, so being in the mix, or potentially running the whole thing. I'm not sure if they would be allowed to do that sort of competition reasons, but that's something that Andy Burnham said he wouldn't rule out if it was a possibility. But on the sort of bigger things like strategic planning, I mean, that's something that I don't think we've heard a lot from the Conservatives on. At the Labour Party conference last year, we heard Keir Starmer going big on sort of house building, and Rachel Reeves talking about backing the builders and not the blockers. And what we're still sort of, I think we're lacking a bit of detail on who's going to hold that power to make it happen. So they talked about putting more planning officers in local authorities to get things through, and having sort of a strategic unit, a national strategic unit to help get things through. In terms of who's going to hold the power to make decisions on big infrastructure projects, I asked the Shadow Business Secretary, Jonathan Reynolds, and, you know, it's not his brief, but he was saying sort of, we'd be of the view that where there's a mayor, those sort of decisions should be taken by that local representative. Whether that means that power is sort of devolved down from government, or whether it's, you know, the mayor would supersede a council policy, it's not quite clear. I think the general line has been they're going to give mayors strategic powers, powers over sort of policy, setting out what the general policy in the sort of area should be, with council still making the sort of the decisions on the specifics. So that would be another difference in Greater Manchester, and of course in the rest of the country. But as you said, one of the big things for other parts of the country is being able to get that bus reform in quicker, because it's something that took 6 years in Greater Manchester. And it was the outgoing chief executive of the Greater Manchester Combined Authority often referred to it as sort of one of the most difficult things he had to do, the way the legislation was written. So it will, you know, there will be a difference felt in other areas for sure. And we're just waiting for the details from a more sort of local angle here in Greater Manchester as to what it will mean for us.
One interesting line I saw in your piece is about, you know, the economy more widely. And I think one of the big criticisms of the Conservative government is their failure to provide any kind of industrial strategy for, you know, the future of industry in the country as a whole, but also the regions. And I see that Labour, in its new regional economic plan, would make it incumbent upon combined authorities. They would be duty-bound to develop local growth plans that will act as a guide for the government nationally, which is an idea that some business leaders seem to favour. But I'm just kind of interested in your view more widely on, it seems like in a few areas, the Labour has had to downgrade the ambition of what it's offering. I mean, you think about green jobs, and obviously we were asking Andy Burnham and Steve Rotherham, the Metro mayors, about this a few weeks ago. Labour has massively scaled back how much it's promising to invest in green jobs because of the state of the economy, and they say they just can't afford to do it anymore. And you hear that from Angela Rayner in other subjects as well. I mean, how much do you think has the current sort of bad state of the economy made it hard for Labour to make big transformative promises?
I think ultimately, I don't think this is unique to this era of the Labour Party, because of the common criticism of Labour's record on the economy, whether right or wrong, they always have to make sure, as any party should, that the sums add up. And I suppose having sort of a more difficult economic situation as we do now makes it harder to make those sums add up, makes it harder to make those commitments. I mean, another example, as you mentioned, that Angela Rayner, that I asked her about, was council funding. And there just wasn't sort of much of an answer beyond sort of, you know, we're not in charge at the moment, we need to look at the finances and then decide what we're going to do. But yeah, it does make it harder to make those commitments, because you don't know where that, I mean, even looking at the current government, that from sort of one 6 monthly statement to another, the amount of headroom and sort of the kind of commitments they can make has changed quite a lot. So yeah, I think it does make it quite difficult to make those commitments, because ultimately when it comes to writing a manifesto, you're going to have to make it all add up.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, one of the, I guess, interesting sort of things that's developed in the last few years in Northern politics is the growing importance of Metro mayors like Andy Burnham, like Ben Houchen in Tees Valley, in other parts of the North as well. They're getting more powers, more influence. But obviously, most of these mayors are Labour mayors. And so inherently, I guess, there's a bit of a combative relationship between those Labour mayors and the Conservative government. If you think about things like the axing of HS2 up in the North, and, you know, imposal of lockdown restrictions during the pandemic. I mean, I would say that most of the mayors seem to have quite a good relationship with Michael Gove, the Levelling Up Secretary. But do you think things will change a lot once, if and when a Labour government gets in and you've got Labour mayors interacting with a Labour government? Will that change the dynamic, do you think?
I think it will. And taking the Greater Manchester example, there will be a shadow cabinet, cabinet members, if they form a government, that are Greater Manchester MPs. So there'll be people right at the top of government fighting Greater Manchester's corner. I'm sure the same could be said of other parts of the North, where you've got sort of Labour MPs in senior positions within the shadow cabinet. So I think it will make a difference. I don't think someone like Andy Burnham is going to sort of stop fighting and you know, as he describes it, taking that place-based approach. I mean, it'll be interesting when he's, as you say, like a Labour mayor under a Labour government, whether those fights will be as public as they have been under the Conservatives. But I'm sure those, and it's not unique to Andy Burnham, I'm sure mayors will still be having to sort of fight their area's corner, especially if the purse strings are sort of kept quite tight by the Treasury. So I think there will be a difference, but we probably shouldn't overstate it, especially given the difficult economic circumstances that you set out earlier.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's a fascinating area. We will see how it develops as we get closer to the election. Joe Timmon, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now let's hear from Alex Niven, our main guest today. Alex Niven, welcome to the Northern Agenda podcast.
Hello, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Just to introduce your book, tell us about your story, your personal story. What's your background in the north of England, and what prompted you to write the North will rise again.
Yeah, so I grew up in West Northumberland in a relatively remote part of the Northeast. And I sort of talk about this in the book. It has a kind of memoir thread running throughout it. So the first house that I lived in was this kind of former mining terrace in the middle of nowhere, which was a good, you know, poetic starting point for this book about the north of England, if nothing else. So I went to school in Northumberland, moved down south to go to university, lived in various places in mainly the south of England and throughout the world, and then returned to the Northeast in the mid-2010s to work at Newcastle University. So I'm a lecturer at Newcastle University, and you know, obviously a writer, and again, yeah, there's a kind of as part of the sort of memoir aspect of the book, I sort of take this experience of exile and return as a chance to kind of reflect on, you know, what's brought the north of England to its present position. You know, when I returned to the region, to the Northeast in the 2010s, the mid-2010s, it was quite clearly suffering quite badly from austerity and all of the kind of government cuts that had happened in the kind of 10 or so years since I'd been away. So that's my basic experience. Grew up in the Northeast, went down south. I lived in Manchester for a while, actually, for a couple of years, which I also talk about in the book. But yeah, had this experience of sort of coming back as a returning exile, as it were, about 10 years ago. And this is, you know, my kind of starting point as a person, as a human being, for writing the book.
And I imagine it gave you a bit of a different perspective on the north of England, going away for a few years and then coming back to it after living in different parts of the world. Perhaps you saw the north in a bit of a different light.
Yeah, I mean, I think first and foremost, living elsewhere made me appreciate the north of England in a way that I perhaps wouldn't have done if I hadn't gone away, or maybe I would, I don't know. But certainly for me, I you know, was lucky enough that I was able to return. It had been a kind of long-running dream to sort of get a job, you know, in the Northeast where I'd grown up. But it's, as we know, quite difficult often to, you know, to find a job. It's much easier to find employment in London and the Southeast. So yeah, I think, you know, as well as being somewhat in, you know, in despair about the sort of the political context of, you know, money being withdrawn from local councils and arts funding and et cetera, overwhelmingly, you know, I was really relieved, you know, to be back in the Northeast when I did get back, and being away had really made me appreciate what's special about the North.
And the book is described as an in-depth exploration of the importance of the North of England in the modern era. I mean, what's the sort of central thesis behind it? What are you trying to say broadly with the book?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it's not necessarily a book with a single sort of polemical point. You know, other than to say that, you know, the book sort of ranges over various attempts to revive the North, mainly over the last sort of 60 or 70 years, mainly kind of post-World War II, sort of looking at various attempts at, well, sometimes kind of very deliberate sort of political, cultural regeneration schemes. At other times, you know, at various kind of artists and musicians and writers from the North or based in the North who've tried to kind of dream a better future for the North. And, you know, I think, you know, so in some ways, sadly, I think, you know, given that the North is still, we still have regional inequality in this country, the North of England is still at the wrong end of a range of socio-political statistics that many people, most people will know about. We'd have to say that most of those attempts at kind of reviving, regenerating the North have either failed or at least succeeded only very partially. And I think arising out of that, I think, you know, if there is a point to the book, you know, a kind of central thesis, it's that, you know, I think you have to really go big or go home with these attempts to revive, regenerate the North. A lot of them have failed because they've been sort of very tentative, sometimes quite superficial, often very sort of short-lived. I think if you're going to kind of do away with regional inequality and get away from this very, very, you know, hard centralization of the country and its institutions and economy in London, then you're probably going to have some kind of radical solution, and what radical way of redressing that centralized dynamic. You know, what that is, I don't know exactly, but, you know, you're probably looking at some kind of major constitutional reform, you know, to tackle this quite kind of deep-seated problem of regional inequality.
Well, I guess in that respect, you're in line with Andy Burnham and Steve Rotherham, aren't you? I know they've got a book out at the moment where their 10-point plan for the North includes various constitutional changes, like I think the end of the whip system and the abolition of the Lords and replacing it with a regional assembly and that kind of thing, sort of quite radical changes to the power structures of this country. So that's interesting. I really liked this line from the book where you said, "The underlying motive for everything I write here is to show how the North can and should be, and for me always has been, a place of endless subtlety, exceptional generosity, fierce love, and utopian possibility," which is lovely. I mean, what did you mean by that? Because I guess for a lot of people, if you don't live in the North or don't have any experience of the North, you perhaps have a view of the North that it's full of people complaining about how they don't have enough money and don't have enough power and so forth. But actually, for those of us who live in the North, it's got all kinds of wonderful things going for it, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think, you know, because of the memoir element to the book, that passage arose out of a need to make clear that, you know, my account of the North is just ultimately, you know, even though I try very hard to be objective, obviously, it is my account, and there are sort of different accounts. And, you know, for me, this is what the North means. It is, you know, where I'm from and a central part of my identity, and it's where I experienced, you know, a lot of the things that made me who I am. And you know, you have to kind of ultimately, you know, if you're broadly happy with who you are, say that those are good things. But yeah, also a big purpose or goal with writing the book was to try to get beyond, you know, the North is, as you say, really unusually limited, I think, by cliches and by the fact that the cultural narrative is often written from the centre, from London, where most of our cultural institutions are, and there's often a kind of patronising dynamic in terms of how the North's portrayed. It's, you know, either, yeah, as you say, portrayed as a kind of, you know, bleak place where people are always complaining and a bit dour, or there's a kind of more apparently positive you know, approach, which is that the North of England is this, you know, wonderful sort of cozy place, a kind of tourist industry place where, you know, you've got the kind of Lake District and, you know, various places that, for, you know, great for kind of, you know, holidays, essentially. And, you know, that bleeds through into certain, you know, a certain wing of publishing. You get quite a lot of books which are, you know, conforming to this quite sort of cozy narrative about the North. So I wanted to write a book that was very, very positive and passionate about the North, but also suggesting that it's a very complicated, you know, culturally sophisticated, intellectually nuanced place that tried to sort of get beyond some of these stereotypes that often kind of filter down from the centre.
Yeah, it's funny because I'm reading George Orwell's The Road to Wigan Pier at the moment, classic book that I've never read, and it's an amazing book, but obviously it tells a particular story of the bleak lives that the miners and people who live in slum habitation in the North have to endure. And yeah, you do sometimes feel like that it's books like that, quite outdated books that give people in the Southeast their view of Northern England. You mentioned Northern you know, identity and how you identify as being from the North. I mean, I'm interested in your view on whether there is a uniquely Northern identity as opposed to lots of different sort of more local regional identities. I mean, do you think there is something or anything that everyone in the North can unite behind as a sort of cultural milestone or something that they can identify with, or is it just the lack of proximity from London, or maybe, you know, the bad transport links that we have to put up with up here? Is there something that defines northernness, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is, broadly speaking. Obviously, you know, when you're dealing with millions and millions of people, you know, it's obviously going to be very tentative, and you're going to have people that don't fit into that. And, you know, any attempt to talk about an identity that broad is not going to be come without caveats and qualifications. And also, as you say, you know, clearly there are kind of, you know, different regions within the North, and people feel differently depending on whether they're from the Northeast or Northwest, Yorkshire and the Humber are the kind of, you know, government office regions. And then within the Northeast, within the Northwest, within Yorkshire, you have, you know, different towns and cities, et cetera, et cetera. Nonetheless, I think, you know, I don't think I'm alone in thinking that, you know, certainly when you go away from the North, you feel the pull of the North as, you know, something that has at least relatively distinct identity. And, you know, coming back here brings that home, I think. You know, as to what that involves, I think it becomes a lot more difficult to define. But I think, you know, the legacy of the Industrial Revolution is obviously something that was very, very central to the North, to the North's history, you know, in all sorts of profound historical ways. You know, both the kind of rise of industry, and then obviously more recently when that industry has sort of disappeared, that is something that, you know, most parts of the North share. You know, I think the distance from London is something, perhaps that's something we share with, you know, Wales, Scotland, parts of the Southwest, but that is something that, you know, unites different parts of the North. You know, there are various other things like, you know, the history of the Labour Party, the history of football, you know, these kind of cultural presences that are, you know, very central to the identity of the North. They're not, you know, exclusively Northern, but I think when you put all these things together, I think, you know, many, if not most, people feel this kind of collection of cultural values and histories as having, you know, some kind of collective Northern aspect, which we can identify.
I'm glad to hear you say that, as someone whose job is predicated on the idea that there is a Northern identity and a sense of Northernness. I think you're right that it's not just one thing, is it, that sort of defines being Northern? It's a combination of different things in different quantities, depending on where you are. I mean, going on to sort of more political matters, it feels to me a bit like some of the government's decision making in recent years. And you say, as you say, there have been various attempts to equalise regional inequalities, but particularly recently, since the time of Boris Johnson, say, it's more had the effect of splintering Northern unity by sort of playing different bits of the North off against each other, making them bid for different pots of money and dividing the North up into different areas. I mean, would you agree with that? Do you think there's a sense of that happening in recent years?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're sort of venturing onto sort of quite complicated ground in terms of the you know, the kind of political makeup of the country and different models of devolution and so on and so forth. But yeah, generally I'd agree with that. I mean, I think, you know, obviously the kind of post 2010 narrative as you allude to has been the metro mayoralties, you know, having these mayors in certain parts of the North but not others. I think, you know, that's worked very well in some parts of the country, as you said earlier. In, you know, the Greater Manchester, I'm, you know, generally a fan of Andy Burnham and what he's achieved in terms of the transport system. You know, I don't think he's perfect, but I think that metro mayoralty has worked pretty well. It's less clear whether it's worked in other parts of the country, partly, you know, in the Northeast, for example, because of exactly this, you know, not necessarily playing off of different micro parts of the region together, but the fact that, you know, our metro mayoralty, you know, up to now only reaches the Tyne. It's just north of Tyne. It doesn't venture south of the Tyne, which means you know, the Metro Mayor here doesn't have control of the transport system. So yeah, I mean, I think I would agree with that assessment. I think it is, you know, a model of devolution that's quite fragmented, such that it, you know, works well in some cases, but not in others, and as such, does have this element of kind of competition and kind of, you know, squabbling between different kind of sub-regions.
There's not many bodies or organisations that represent the North as a whole. Perhaps the only, maybe the only one that has sort of statutory status is Transport for the North, which is the sort of body in charge of strategic transport in Northern England. But even that has had its funding cut quite significantly in the few years since it's been in existence, and it came up with a revision for what high-speed rail link should look like in the North, and the government completely ignored it and decided to do something else, and then took most of its powers and funding away, which doesn't give you much sense that the government believes in the idea of a sort of strong North acting as one unit. So on a related topic, you, in your book, you've called for a revival of Northern politics and society by way of something that you describe as radical regionalism. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, an extension of what we've been talking about, really, that, you know, you have to have, that, you know, a lot of the models that have worked up to now have been not very radical and very kind of compromised in the extreme, such that, you know, you've had various proposals for devolution, but, you know, none of them have, you know, really followed through. Obviously, you have the notable example of the sort of failed referendum for the North East Assembly in 2004, but also the Metro Mayoralties, which, you know, as we've said, you know, have worked well in some contexts, but not others. And, you know, I think, coming back to what we were saying earlier, you know, I think all of this is a part of the constitution of the country as a whole, which is very outdated and very kind of medieval in lots of senses. So I think, you know, radical regionalism acknowledges that if you want to have devolution that's going to actually sort of balance out the power dynamic that we have in this country, it's, you know, it's going to have to be, you know, pretty vigorous, going to have to be very ambitious. It's going to have to involve some kind of big constitutional change, you know, as you were saying, you know, the kind that, for example, you know, Burnham and Rotherham recommend or allude to in their book. And that, you know, there isn't just, you know, the Northern powerhouse or levelling up or whatever, you know, quite superficial scheme that, you know, the latest government wants to kind of put forward as their attempt to redress regional inequality. You're going to have a kind of radical solution to this problem that involves rearranging, you know, how this country is set up constitutionally in all sorts of, you know, profound ways.
And finally, Alex, your book is called The North Will Rise Again. I'll give it another little plug. Obviously, that's a, as well as a book title, it's a prediction, I guess, it seems to me. I mean, are you optimistic that the North will rise again? Do you have a sort of, are you full of optimism for the future?
Yeah, I mean, optimism for the future. I think the present is a little bit grim, isn't it? And I think, you know, I think there's, at the moment, we're, you know, I'm not really a fan of the current government or the next government, to be honest. So, you know, I think we're living in an age of sort of, you know, stasis and waiting for some, you know, kind of, you know, something to kind of shake things up, because at the moment we seem to be kind of sleepwalking a bit culturally and politically. And I think, you know, that's the way things are now. And I think, unfortunately, that's probably how things will continue even after the next general election. Nonetheless, I think, you know, longer term, I am very optimistic and very hopeful, you know, partly because I think, you know, there's no point in not being hopeful. You might as well, be hopeful while you're still alive, as it were. But, you know, I think, there's something about this country which teaches us to almost think that, you know, things are the way they are and they can't change, and things have been, you know, the way they are in terms of the way the country's set up and the way culture is for hundreds of years, and we can't change anything. You know, actually, things have changed radically many times before, and they will again. it's just a case of when. I think things will change in terms of the way the United Kingdom's set up, you know, how countries like Scotland, Wales and Ireland relate to this quite kind of weird entity, which is the United Kingdom. I think things are likely to change with the monarchy, the House of Lords and so on and so forth. And I think, you know, when those changes happen, and of course, you know, we've got climate change and you know, all sorts of economic things going on globally. I think when those things happen, that will open up a space to sort of radically rethink the way we exist in this country, you know, in England, Britain, in particularly the English regions like the north of England. So I'm very hopeful that, you know, there will at least be a space for things to change in a positive way. And it's really just up to us to try to think about, you know, what that might look like.
So the north will rise again, but we might just have to be a bit patient for it to
yeah,
happen.
Not too long in the future, but yeah, maybe not right now, but yeah, soon.
Well, the book is, as I said, is called The North Will Rise Again, In Search of the Future in Northern Heartlands. It's out in paperback. Is that right now, Alex?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Good stuff. Well, thank you. Thank you, Alex Niven, for coming on.
Thanks very much, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Northern Agenda podcast. And don't forget, you can subscribe to our daily newsletter at thenorthernagenda.co.uk. It's more important than ever for Northern voices to be heard. The Northern Agenda is a laudable production for Reach. It's presented by me, Rob Parsons, and it's produced by Daniel J. McCoughlin. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to The Northern Agenda wherever you listen to your podcasts, including Apple and Spotify. See you next week.